Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network with your humble host, Tom Metzger, Table Tommy. This show originates and is being broadcasted live from the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana. Right next door is Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern. It's a friendly little tavern where friends meet to drink and sometimes eat. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase tanks, half tracks, or any other weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar. If you like, Tommy invites you to visit his big website, resist.com, and spend some time up there and look around. You can read news and views, listen to archive radio shows, listings of items to buy, information on where to send you donations, and just a lot of good useful information. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy another show from the Insurgent Radio Network.
She sounds a sexy lady, I'll tell you that. Let me get my little sound up here a little higher. Let's see. How's that? I think I'm picking up a little hummy dum dum dum. I think I got a ground problem around here someplace. And if I set the mic, I got a desk here that's a giant commercial desk that I got out of a surplus place. But I would have rather it have been wood. It's metal. And sometimes you set a mic on it and you pick up some type of hum. I think I probably should ground the whole damn desk to a big old copper rod down into the ground or something. But anyhow. Hey, it's the fourth month. It's April the 10th, 2014. And this is Thor's Day. And I want to thank everybody that sent me happy birthday wishes. Yeah, and got several calls yesterday, not only from my family around, but from some friends that I've known for years, and I'm surprised they remember my birthday. Well, anyhow, that's over with. Now we got to get busy on 76 and see if I can make it through 76, I'll tell you. Me and my squeeze went out to dinner last night, and then we did something I haven't done in so long that it's hard to remember when I last did it. We went bowling, and I used to be pretty good, not great, not like old Steve Nagy used to be. If you, any of you old guys that used to bowl know, he was a national champion for years and years. So anyhow, yeah, but I didn't realize now that it's all automatic with your scorekeeping. It's all computerized. And last time I bowled, I was still using pencil and paper and to keep track of things. And I want to tell you, I thought I could slip right back into it and be a real good bowler. But I'm telling you, when you haven't done it for 20, 30 years, it ain't going to happen. I rolled about 10 gutter balls in a row. I had good delivery. I had the eye on the pins. But I was embarrassed. Very embarrassed. So I got to go start practicing again. And another thing, I forgot to use the arrows. You know, those arrows they put on those alleys, those are for something. And you're supposed to line them up and use them and so forth like that. But my gal beat me out by 4 pins. Man, I'll tell you, it's an embarrassing situation. So anyhow, fun was had by all, and it's good exercise, too. Those balls weigh about, what, 10, 15 pounds? Not mine. I mean, the ones at the bowling alley. If I set the old microphone up here on a tablet about an inch thick. It seems to minimize that low hum in the background until I figure that out. But if I use a USB mic straight in, I don't have that trouble. But the problem is you want to use stereo mix when you've got a mic, and then you're also putting clips off of an external device on, and also the internal MP3 clips that you've got. And it's a miserable to switch around if you don't use the stereo mix and then an external mixer. So anyhow, that's my problem, which is not a real problem unless you let it become a problem. I got this new computer for my birthday. Well, I'm going to get that all hooked up and see how that operates, doing the same thing through the same inputs and outputs. Tommy up there, I'm not going to tell you exactly where, for his donation. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, see, Wolf Southern California, too, thanks for your donation. That helps.
I gave you this message last night, or the night before. Tommy forgot about it. But anyways, I had heard on one of our local liberal stations, this talk show, you know, these communist hippie assholes backing up the blacks for every reason and blaming everything on the whites for every reason. Well, anyways, the guy, the main guy, his cohort of old hippie broad from the old days, she's a rock and roller still in a rock and roll group. But anyways, she brought up, she wasn't sure, but she, I don't know what the sources were, but she heard a story from somewhere that George Zimmerman actually made a painting, drew a painting of it, Trayvon Martin, and sold it for thousands of dollars. If you can verify that from any sources you might have, and please let us know if that's true. I think that's hilarious. That's terrific. Anyways, this is Pat from Detroit. 28 p.m.
I'm Tom 88. It's your favorite rhythmic whisper around you. I want you to please.
That raped my sister and killed my sister? I'll blow your balls off with my Glock. Don't mistake me for a Republican candidate. I just thought it was kind of abusive.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Except if it did, unless his sister did get raped and killed.
Well, unfortunately, she did. The guy has taken a very definite attitude about it, you know. And the woman who's running against him, she says, oh, I grew up on a pig farm. I castrated pigs when I was a girl. I know how to cut pork. You know, she's making a joke about this. This guy's just simply saying, you come to my house, you want to harm my family, you come through my front door, you will face the consequences.
I think I heard that gal on TV or radio, somebody gave her some time. I forget, some station was trying to make it funny or something.
Yeah, well, he's trying to invite her to an open debate and all this. Apparently, she's very, very uncomfortable with that sort of thing. You know, hey, so be it, man. Make them squirm.
Did they catch the guy that killed his sister?
Yes, they did, and he was in prison.
Is he dead?
No, no, he's not. He's still living on the people's tax dollar, you know.
Well, the guy should take care of business.
No, maybe he may he get what he deserves while he's imprisoned by some other inmates.
Sure.
You know?
Not that hard to do in prison. It happens all the time.
Oh, indeed it does. Indeed it does. There are things that can happen that, you know, none of us have any control over, right?
A lot of these guys think they're beyond reach once they're in the prison, but they're not beyond reach.
Oh, they're actually easy to get to, you know,
yeah.
And it's the wonderful thing about it is you very rarely have to dirty your own hands with the people there, especially these bastards who are child abusers and want to harm the innocent and people who torture animals.
Sure.
There are people in prison who, you know...
Yeah.
It happens, like they used to say, right?
That's right. Okay, I got to get on to my show now, so I'll...
good luck to you, Thomas. Be safe.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye. According to a progressive newspaper out of Phoenix, we've got good news, boys and girls. Detention and deportation await those seeking asylum in America. I'm thinking of asking for asylum someplace else myself. Hussein Mohammed took a hard road to America, born into a minority clan, a nation rife with racial conflict. The boyish 24-year-old, gangly limbs and intense brown eyes, describes fleeing his village in Somalia in 2012 after gunmen threatened to kill him. That's all he needed to say. Mohammed says he was forced to quit his jobs as an English teacher and a taxi driver and escape to neighboring Kenya. I wonder why they came to his door with guns. After making his way to South Africa, he forked over his life savings to human smugglers who shipped him across the Atlantic to Brazil and guided him north through the jungles of South and Central America into Mexico. When he finally arrived at the border crossing at Brownsville, Texas last summer, Mohammed thought he had it made. Mohammed thought he'd safely reached the end of a harrowing 10-month journey. Now he could go into the interlands of the United States and take a job from some poor white guy, some American citizen. He had no inkling. Of course, nobody invited this clown. Did you invite this clown? I didn't invite this clown. So he's an uninvited guest, right? He's an uninvited invader. He had no inkling of the ordeal waiting him on the other side of the Rio Grande. Well, the way he sounds, it couldn't be much worse than Somalia, huh? Mohammed approached the U.S. Border Patrol agent and recounted his story. He explained that he wanted to seek asylum, a classification of refugee status granted to people who arrive in the United States having fled persecution in their own homeland. And, of course, it's usually based on their word alone that they're persecuted. And I'd say two-thirds or maybe 80% of the world could claim they're persecuted by somebody, some just by their mother-in-laws. He immediately was immediately handcuffed. Oh, shit. Placed in immigration detention, a cold, cramped cell at a privately owned and operated prison facility. There you go. There's your capitalist, predatory capitalist now in the private prison business. Actually, it probably was a better place than where he came from in Somalia, in that cold, damp cell. Soon after, along with hundreds of other detainees, he was herded onto a cargo plane and transferred without explanation to a jail in Newark, New Jersey. Well, he's getting to travel more than I get to travel. 8 months later, Mohammed is seated in the jail's makeshift visitor center, a stuffy gymnasium with rows of plastic chairs and tables arranged on a basketball court. It's been more than a year since he spoke with his family in Somalia, and he fears the worst. Well, he should go back there and take care of him. He knows exactly one person in America, a fellow Somalia immigrant who lives somewhere in California. He dreams of moving there, finding work, finding a white broad, settling down, starting a little liquor store on the corner, even though it's against his religion. Instead, he will likely be deported, shipped back to the war-torn country on the Horn of Africa he worked so hard to escape. Mohammed's request for asylum was denied because he lacks a passport or other documents to confirm his identity. He's fled an appeal, or filed an appeal, and his detention ticks on indefinitely. Well, he may end up like Guantanamo. He may be in New Jersey for the next 20 years. But at least they're not letting him loose into general society like they have millions of other Somalians. Yes, millions. The State Department of the United States is your worst enemy. If anybody ever attacks any area of government, it should be the State Department. That would be my opinion. They're the worst bastards. They get us into wars and occupation. Then after they've blown the shit out of third world countries and robbed all their goodies, then they bring them over here and throw the people who are fleeing the disaster into our white communities. The whiter the better for the State Department. That shows you how perverse and irredeemable every one of these people in the U.S. State Department is. And the time will come. There are no statutory limitations to the amount of time a non-citizen like Muhammad may be held in immigration detention. Just put his ass on a boat, on a plane, ship him back to Somalia, drop him off, you know, give him a parachute. When the process goes smoothly, asylum seekers tend to be released in a matter of weeks. Many end up in prison for much longer. About 6,000 survivors of torture, exiles from Iran, Marama, Syria, and other brutal regimes were detained in immigration jails while seeking asylum during the past 3 years. Yeah, these are people who are victims of the U.S. government's military shenanigans in these foreign countries. They destabilize them, and then the people are scared to death, and they run for their lives, and then they try to come over here. One of these days, maybe we'll have to be doing that. Where the hell are we going to go? It's a real tragic, said Amelia Wilson, a progressive, liberal, socio-red staff attorney for the American Friends Service Committee. That's the Quakers. That's Christianity. There you go. American Friends Service Committee, a faith-based organization that aids asylum seekers. I like that, faith-based. They have a faith, but they have no evidence. They have lots of faith, but no evidence. And they got those people in decisions of making decisions about who comes and who goes. That's just like with the Indian situation back in the old days. You had part of the people wanted to make Christians out of them, and the rest of them, the people wanted to either kill them or shove them clear out of the North America. Quote, they're fleeing persecution. Many of them have just fled institutions of incarceration in their home country. Through guile or luck or the right contacts, they manage to get out of their country. They come here and they're promptly detained. They're shocked. They're told this is land of opportunity. You're a land of opportunity. I come here make money. I come here make buy liquor store, sell liquor to kids. Yeah, sell sex magazines. Even though I'm a Muslim, I'm not supposed to do that. But to make money, I do it because I want a better life. That's your expense, stupid goy, stupid white. They're not criminals. They say. In fact, they're following the legal procedure the government was put in place for them to get protection. Well, probably the people that came to his door in Somalia were the cops, because he's a well-known guy that's stealing tires off cars and stealing cars and stuff like that in Somaliland. So cops come to pick him up and he ran, and there you go. Well, I just hate the fact that we're feeding the bastard. You know, years and years will go by and put clothes on him, feed him, and that takes away from our white prisoners in real prisons here in the United States, and these predatory capitalist private prisons, to where a lot of the places they got to buy their own shoes and own clothes, and they don't have a job. So, but we'll take care of these people coming in here. Yeah. For years, they've been there, yeah. Okay. What a fucked up system we live under. It is totally fucked up. The immigration overhaul the Senate passed in June 2013 addresses several issues with asylum. But the legislation remains stalled in the House of Representatives. Everything's stalled in the House of Representatives except their paychecks. Raising concerns about fraudulent claims. Oh, duh. Some Republican leaders now are pushing draconian measures that would put even more asylum seekers behind bars. We don't want them behind bars. We want them to be free in the country they came from. They can go back there and work it out. Yeah. You know. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Gulati, a Republican and probably a Christian, he's trying to play both sides of the fence, has said the asylum system is exploited by illegal invaders in order to enter and remain in the United States. Duh. This is the stupidity of these leaders. Of course they are, because you have rolled out the red carpet, even your television program. Oh, everybody's welcome here, man. Just come on in. Take my house, take my car, take my job, because we love the baby Jesus. The tone of immigration politics, even when it comes to asylum seekers, has gotten really vicious. No, not vicious. Staunchly on the side of this argument is Alina Daz. Sounds a little mestizo to me. Co-director of the Immigration Rights Clinic of the New York University School of Law. Well, my dear, there is no such thing as rights, even though you keep putting it out. There's only privileges, of which the State Department gives people the privileges. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of Nigeroos from Somalia and all over the place. People generally have forgotten what it means to be seeking asylum in our country. It's really disturbing, and I think it's a sad commentary on how easily a minority of elected officials can hijack an issue that should really speak to the core of American values. What the hell is American values? Do you know what American values are? Huh. Well, these people like this woman, probably a progressive liberal that believes that the environment is being destroyed. Well, population destroys environment, increased population. Increased immigration across the borders and in through the airports and everything else, the more population, the more they're going to screw up the ecology. Look at the Mexican neighborhoods in any city they're in. I mean, it's looks like the pest hole of India. Look at East LA. People drag their culture with them. If you want to know about a people, look at the way they live. I mean, you know, they got 15 cars in the yard. They got three hogs in the back, some fighting cocks there dealing drugs out the side window like a McDonald's hamburger stand. That's the invader's culture, and that's what he genetically has produced, and that's what this woman wants to bring here. These people are insane. They're just as insane as the Christian type, or the Islamic, or the Jew. The Jew, Judaism, and I don't think, you know, sometimes I don't think Judaism is quite as crazy as some forms of Christianity, because they tend to be sort of ethnocentric, of getting in a neighborhood and not wanting other people in. Well, that's a good attitude, really. Look at those Orthodox up there in New York. They take over block by block. That's what our people should do. Retake the cities block by block. But it's the Christian evangelists and now the imams of the Islamic fraud that are doing that here in this country and all over Europe and everything. Yeah. So there you go. Though the political climate looks bleak for advocates of wholesale asylum, an ongoing pilot project offers a glimmer of hope to bring more in here. What is it on the Statue of Liberty? Give us your wretched refuse. Give us your garbage. It tells you right on there. Give us your wretched refuse. That's straight out, give us your garbage. You want more garbage? Okay, they'll give you more garbage. The project allows Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials, where are they at? Even in Fallbrook, California, before I left, we would turn in 50 wetbacks at a time, and they wouldn't even go out and check them. at facilities in New York City, Newark, San Antonio, Chicago, Minneapolis, St. Paul, to release selected detainees seeking asylum into a program coordinated by the Lutheran Christ Insanity Immigration and Refugee Service. You see, every step along the way, your greatest enemy may not be strictly Judaism. I think your most active and really serious enemy is Christianity. I'm sure of that. Because everywhere you find them trying to overrun your country with non-white people and anything that's anti-white, anything that works against the white race in North America, some church is for, or many churches, or all churches are for. Yeah. So you might as well get off your high horse, anybody that's still hanging on to Christianity. You can't serve two masters, and that master is death. Death formed over. And if you're sitting there thinking, well, how could I do without the Jewish God? And he is definitely a Jewish God. Well, all you have is nature's forces. If you want to call it God, you can, but I think nature's a better term for it. All the powers of the universe and everything else got nothing to do with some jerk sitting on a cloud or with a beard and snooping into every bedroom in the country, all that kind of stuff. That's where they get into that stuff, wanting to know everything about you, even your sex life. That comes from their practice of religion, because that's what God does. He's a nosy bastard. He knows everything you're doing day and night. Oh, yeah. Fuck off, God. I'll take nature. Yeah, I will. Anyhow, everywhere you'll see the white race, and even the the sex change type thing in this country it's all come out of a reaction against religion. Has driven people into devil worship and even homosexuality and so forth. You can't tell me that this very quick and giant shift into massive homosexuality is an accident. No, I'm not buying it. I'm a extreme heterosexual myself, and I think I'm going to put a sign out in front of my house, protect the heterosexual community. Because the heterosexual community is indeed under attack. Of course, not by all homosexuals, but the powerful ones. And they've got a baseball bat. And like Bill Maher said, you got to watch it. You mess with the homosexuals and the transsexuals, they'll whack you. Well, they will. They'll try to get you. And destroy your career, destroy your job, destroy everything. Well, anyhow, that's the name of that game. In case you wondered, that's from the New Times out of Phoenix. It's a social Marxist-type newspaper that I can't say it any other way. They must hate white people, the white race. Because anybody who stands up for the white race, they hate, so I guess they hate the white race. Which in many cases, I guess they hate themselves. Well, I'm sending you out this breaking news on health, and I'll give you just a part of it. An over-the-counter supplement designed to ease osteoporosis, I always have trouble with that word, prolonged the lifespan of lab mice by nearly a tenth, scientists said Tuesday. This would translate into an average 8-year longevity gain if the result could be repeated in humans. Swiss researchers reported in the journal Nature Communications. A team led by Michael Ristau at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich used a common dietary supplement called glucosamine on laboratory mice after testing it on worms. Glucosamine is a natural occurring compound found in the lubricating fluid which surrounds the joints. It is widely sold over the counter as a supplement to combat osteoporosis or osteoarthritis. The commonest form of arthritis, although studies into its efficacy have thrown up mixed results. Ristow's team first tested a tiny dose on a well-researched lab animal, a nematode worm called a Caenorhabditis elegans, and found it extended its lifespan by some 5%. They then experimented with 146 mice just under 2 years, the rough equivalent of 65 years in human terms. The mice given glucosamine lived an average of 10% longer than the counterparts who did not get the supplement, which in human terms is about 8 years. Well, there's more to this, and I sent it along to you. You can take it for what it's worth. I know about that material for your joints. I've never found that it seemed to do that much good for me. I don't know. I've been taking a massive amounts of plain raisins, and I noticed my joint pains have gone mostly away. That's only after taking quite a bit of raisins for 2 weeks. So maybe a common raisin. So maybe that common raisin has some of the elements in it that I do know it's high in iron, and high in potassium. So maybe that's got a lot to do with it. Raisins are a lot cheaper than medicine, that's for sure. Well, I see this Nevada standoff out there in the high deserts getting pretty stoked up out there. The cops are starting to push themselves around. Federal agents and the Bureau of Land Management officials, and they're getting pretty rough with the population. To that, I simply say, tick, 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 tick. It's only a matter of time. Anyhow, I sent this along to you. It's got the whole video on it. You'll find it quite interesting. And it appears to me to be all white people being set upon by the authorities. Well, I see that there is more information coming in on this head-to-head fight that seems to be shaping up in Nevada over this ranch land and the BLM. I'm sending this on to you on an email, and there's some video with it. These people who wrote this up said it's apparent that the federal government was under the impression that they could simply move into the ranch land surrounding Bunkerville, Nevada, and have their way with the property and livelihood of the Bundy family. What they didn't count on was the outcry from Americans across the country, and now things may be headed to the next level, as Kim Paxton of the Daily Sheeple notes. Citizen militias in several states have been called up. Many members of those organizations are taking up arms and are making their way to Nevada. And it's not just the citizen militias that are preparing to take action. The governor of Nevada has officially condemned the federal government's actions, though he has yet to take any steps afforded to him under state law. Sheriff Richard Mack of Gilbert, Arizona, has weighed in and calls the actions terrorism by the federal government. Well, I've been down this road many times before. I hope it doesn't have the same ending it always has before. Beware. You know, one question I've been asking myself about this stabbing event at the school in Pennsylvania. It keeps saying that it happened around 7 o'clock. My question is, what are all these students doing at the school that early in the morning? As far as I know, school never starts before 8 o'clock. I don't know, maybe this is a different school. Well, let's get into a little bit of history here about the myth of the Jewish race. Of course, I've said this for a long time. There are people, of course, who call themselves Jews who are of different races, but that doesn't make Jew a race. The Jews claim themselves to be a race, but are they? Well, no, I think they just want the benefits of saying they're a race. The earliest references yet found to this singular people is on a statue from the Syrian city of Alaqa, dated to about 1550 BC. The inscription refers to Hapiru, H-A-P-I-R-U, warriors in the land of Kinau, K-N-I-K-I-N-A-N-U, a presence confirmed by clay tablets from the Akhenaten capital of Amarna, referring to marauders in the hill countries of Palestine. The famous stele of Pharaoh Menapotat, dated 1207 BC, records Israel is laid waste, his seed is not. Israel here is a reference to a people, not a territory. The weight of evidence suggests that these original Hebrews coalesced during the Bronze Age from successive migrations, some from the periphery of the Nile Delta in Egyptian. Peru or Aperu meant laborer, but most from across the Jordan and Euphrates River. In their own Semitic tongue, Hebaru meant beyond, suggesting an origin elsewhere. In Babylon, script Hebaru referred to a class of slaves. As a people, therefore, the Hebrews combined Mesopotamian and Egyptian stock, almost certainly drawn from the lowest social order, conceivably including the runaway slaves. One migration, at least, brought with its mountain sky god, Yahweh, destined for higher things. Yeah, there we go. A little bit of that for you today. As barbarous newcomers to what was the land of Canaan, the Semites, speakers of a tongue common to Assyrians, Arabs, and Mesopotamians, took up migratory occupation of the less fertile hill country of the interior. Neither their limited subculture and illiterate donkey nomadism or their social organization, patriarchal or authoritarian, distinguished them from other tent-dwelling pastoralists. These early polytheistic Hebrews scratched an existence in an unpromising land on the fringes of the major civilizations, occasionally moving with their animals into the Nile Delta in times of drought. It seems as if they were joined over time by outcasts or refugees from the more sophisticated Canaanite, Phoenician coastal cities. Israel emerged peacefully and gradually from within Canaanite society, concluded Kerence Armstrong, the noted religious scholar. The Canaanite migrants brought with them cultic practices and images of their traditional gods. The major Canaanite god was El, and the phrase El has conquered gives us the word Israel. The Canaanite god El had a ghostly presence in a host of Jewish heroes: Daniel, Ezekiel, Samuel, Ishmael, Elijah, Elohim, and so on. And of course, these were primarily myths that these people carried along with them. God-inspired names were common throughout the West Semitic language region. Other Canaanite gods included Baal, or the storm god, also honored in a host of Hebrew names: Asherah, a fertility goddess, consort of El; Shalem, a Syrian sun god, later to be honored in the name Jerusalem; Milcom, Chemosh, and so on. Rush Eliminimum is mentioned in the records of the Pharaoh Sesostris III, 1872-1847 B.C. The settlement actually pre-existed long before the tribe of Hebrews made it their own. The site then appears to have been occupied for 300 years until the Jebusites, otherwise known as the Kereti or the Paleti, Cretans or Philistinians, arrived. It will come as an unpleasant shock to many of the God Israel, Yahweh, that he had a female consort, and that early Israelite religion adopted monotheism only in the waning period of the monarchy and not at Mount Sinai. Influenced by these Canaanite cults, but devoid of artistic and metalworking skills of their own, the early Hebrews adopted a way of honoring their god of choice by genital mutilation. This sometimes practice of the Egyptian priesthood became, for the Jews, a tribal obligation, part of the male regeneration organ offered as a blood sacrifice to the jealous god Yahweh. Other gods were worshipped, but Yahweh demanded precedence. Thus, and through though the Hebrews were not a race, the males at least acquired a distinctiveness from other Semitic tribesmen who did not practice circumcision. Women regarded as mere chattels were spared this mutilation. In this period of Proto-Judaism, polygamous males acted as priests for their extended families and kinship groups and exercised absolute authority over wives and children. Whoops. At some point in the 10th century B.C., the Hebrews were completely overwhelmed by the more advanced Philistines. No wonder the Jews hated the Philistines. Moving down from the north, armed with iron weapons and deploying chariots, the Philistines scattered the primitive Hebrew nomads into the land country and a few austere places in the Jordan River Valley. The various Hebrew clans had no single warlord, but were led by tribal elders and shamans. The backward Hebrews remained under the sway of their shamanic judges to a much later date than neighboring peoples. Theirs was a harsh culture of scapegoat sacrifice and collective and inherited guilt, eye for an eye vengeance. As marginalized pastoralists, they were acutely xenophobic and demonized the city dwellers and farmers. With the ebb and flow of empires over the centuries and the endless movement of peoples, we might have expected this marginal tribe to have passed into history, along with countless other peoples assimilated into the greater multitude. But we have a story, a tale of tribal fidelity, with frequent and instructive lapses to a protector god Yahweh who had chosen this people as his very own. For them he had a divine purpose. In particular, the migration into Canaan is given an heroic reinterpretation. No longer do we have a piecemeal migration over the centuries, but a single glorious conquest by a cohesive people. The idolatrous city dwellers of Jericho get their comeuppance, and the whole land is promised to the Jews in perpetuity. They have, it would seem, arrived as a single group from Egypt, released from slavery by divine intervention. The extraordinary story here, I got interrupted there. The extraordinary thing about this history, complete with the verbatim dialogue between man and God, is that it was not written until more than 1,000 years after the supposed events occurred. Isn't that like Christianity, where most of the stuff was written 400 years after the alleged fact? Records one historian, the first millennium of Jewish history as presented in the Bible has no empirical foundation whatsoever. That was from the Cantor, The Sacred Chain, page 51. Okay. In other words, the Jews, these Jews have always been a fraud, especially when they call themselves a race. They have latched their crazy ideas on to certain racial groups. The impressive race history tracing the Jews, the people of Judah, back to Hebrews and Canaan and Israelites in Egypt to a noble ancestor called Abraham, father, it seems, of all races, including Greeks and Arabs. And the whole melodramatic story of the Exodus was concocted at a much later date, after the tribal leadership of these Judean tribesmen had been taken into exile and had learned the rudiments of civilization from their Babylonian captors. This was not at the dawn of time, but in the 7th century B.C., when Greece was already a civilization and Carthage had a maritime empire. So much for the great Jew civilization. The original Hebrew Canaanite occupants of Palestine did pass into history, many including the so-called lost tribes of Israel. Those living in northern Palestine were assimilated by Assyrian conquerors during the 8th century. But the victors, a Persian-sponsored priesthood who settled in Judea in 6th century B.C., wrote a sacred history known to the Jews as the Torah or the Pentateuch, and to the Christians as the first five books of the Old Testament, together with the prophets and wisdom literature. This voluminous text purports to be an account of the trials and tribulations of the Jews through the previous two millennium. Rather oddly, its detail and obvious accuracy peters out the closer it approaches the time when it was actually written. Joshua, supposedly on the rampage in the 13th century B.C., gets vast reportage, whereas several 7th century kings known to history are omitted. Indeed, the 400 years between the last book of the Old Testament, the 5th century Malachi, and the first book of the New Testament echo in a biblical silence. No biblical text gives the conquest of Palestine by Alexander the Great in 323 B.C. a mention. Ptolemy, Egypt's loss of her Palestinian provinces to Syria in 198 B.C. is unrecorded, and these were major events. They're not even there. Minor personages like Julius Caesar and Pompey the Great are overlooked entirely. The books of Maccabees, which should tell us the recent history of successful Jewish rebellion against Greek rule in the 2nd century B.C., are so blatantly filled with error and incoherence that even biblical editors shunted them into the Apocrypha or omitted them entirely. But of course, we're not speaking of history, but rather of sacred testimony designed to control, justify, and inspire. Anyone can be factual. In the Bible, we have a book with purpose. Yeah, right, we sure do. If you want to get all this Christian stuff out of your system and this crazy-ass nonsense about the great, wonderful, God-chosen Jews and their self-constructed God, all you have to do is go to JesusNeverExisted.com. And you got pages and pages and pages and pages of evidence and research that'll let you know what's going on. And if you don't do that and you still cling to this crazy-ass religion of Abrahamic religions, whether it be Islam or Judaism or Christianity, then you might as well pluck out one of your eyes because you're half blind. Remember Abraham? They go on and on and on and on about Abraham. This amazingly righteous phantom has a lot to answer for. Father of many nations, his supposed behavior set a terrifying example. Not only attempted murder of his favorite son, but abandoned to the desert and offspring of his various concubines. Sadly, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all pay homage to this con man and warlord who never actually existed, of course. But that hardly matters to religious zealots.
How did the gospel writers know the stories that they were telling? Were the writers themselves witnesses to the events they described? Had they perhaps been told of these stories by somebody else? Or are they entirely made up stories? When I first heard the Jesus stories as a child, even then I wondered, how did the writers of these stories know the events that they were relating? It was all very well if it was an incident with Jesus and his disciples, but many of the important stories were occasions when there were no other substantial witnesses. For example, it is doubtful who was around for the baptism of Jesus. But the story that troubled me most related to the so-called temptations of Jesus, where in a series of little encounters with the devil, Jesus is first challenged to turn stones to bread. He is then invited to cast himself off the pinnacle of the temple and have angels save him. And finally, he was taken to a mountaintop and offered all the world's countries. Now, what troubles me here is there's no suggestion that anybody else was accompanying Jesus. There was nobody else out there in the desert, was there? There was nobody else taken to the pinnacle of the temple. There was nobody else on that mountaintop. How on earth did the gospel writers know such stories? Now, I've asked this question of Christians, and the most plausible response I've ever had is, well, that's what Jesus spoke about as he led them about the wilderness. He must have on one occasion have said, hey guys, guess what happened when I first got into the Messiah business? There I was on earth, and the devil came along and took me up to the mountaintop. Can we believe such a story? I don't think so. But this problem of having an authentic witness gets worse. The three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all tell a version of the final meeting of Jesus and the disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, the problem here is that the disciples continuously fall asleep, and Jesus chastises them for this dozing off, and then goes off to pray. So, the disciples are sleeping, and Jesus is praying. The Gospel writers record the words of three prayers of Jesus. Luke even intrudes the appearance of an angel, all while the disciples sleep. Now, immediately after that incident, he gets identified by Judas and arrested and taken off for his trial and crucifixion. At no point does Jesus gain the opportunity to regale the fact that he was in the garden praying while they are sleeping. There are no witnesses to that event. What can and has been invented is the dialogue given to Jesus as he prays in that garden. It's just another fantastic story, another ripping yarn from the New Testament.
Now here's the thing. Judging from my mailbox, many believing Christians are very aware of the criminal history of the church. But they excuse themselves from all complicity. The perpetrators of individual cruelties, mass abuse and wars of genocide and conquest were, it seemed, not real Christians at all. Real Christians could do none of these things because Christ, we're told, taught a message of peace and love and humility, even poverty. If only the church had followed the message of Jesus, none of those centuries filled with bloodshed and suffering would have unfolded the way they did. So by a quick sidestep, today's Christians wash their hands of any and all crimes, misdeeds and follies of their forebears. But let's take a closer look at this, because it is mighty strange that for more than 15 centuries and across all the world's continents, self-styled Christians have willfully or unwittingly misunderstood the message of their Lord and robbed when they should have given, punished when they should have helped, and murdered when they should have loved. So why have Christians always got the message wrong? Could it be that the message is rather less straightforward than many of today's more humane Christians naively imagine? Christians, that is, influenced by the world, civilized by science and secularism. The most obvious example to look at is the supposed injunction from Jesus to love your enemies. I just love that bit of nonsense. Such a notion is quite impractical and frankly silly. Pagan philosophers before Jesus expressed a far more nuanced idea of treating enemies with humanity. But let's consider Jesus himself. Did Jesus love his enemies? Well, throughout his earthly ministry, we have many examples presented to us, and his long-running opponents for sure were the Pharisees, the forerunners of the rabbis. In the gospel stories, they challenged Jesus' teachings and behaviour at various points. Now, did Jesus love them despite their challenges? No, he did not. Jesus preached an absolutist belief of good and bad, with no shades of grey. Whoever is not with me is against me, he says. Those who believe will not be damned, but unbelief arouses his anger, his impatience, and his utter abuse. Jesus pours forth a stream of invective against the Pharisees. He threatens insatiable revenge, outer darkness, and eternal punishment, explicitly stated at least 30 times. In Luke 19:27, Jesus calls for the murder in front of him of all those who refuse to worship him. You love your neighbour as yourself, but only if he receives the good news. If not, shake off the dust from your feet, and it'll be more intolerable for them on the day of judgment than the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. Depart, says Jesus, into everlasting fire. Jesus calls his detractors serpents, a generation of vipers. He promises them a fire that is never quenched. In fact, his attitude towards his enemies is an assurance of everlasting torture. Jesus is not Mr. Nice Guy at all, but an intolerant, vindictive, egotistical bully, just like the priests who invented him. The Gospels are an immoral fraud. Thank God they're not true, not history, but just more astounding rubbish from the New Testament.
Well, I'm going to try to sneak in here a little more information to offend your ass. If there's anybody out there yet that's a Christian and don't quite get it, well, come on back and we'll give you some more. I bet you if I took this book, There Never Was a Jesus, which you can get on the internet, and stood outside most of these, especially these evangelical, Republican-type churches, I'd probably get stoned just like they did. I don't mean with marijuana either. If there was stones around there, I'll bet they'd stone my ass right in front of the church. You know, they go crazy, man. Well, let's check in on my buddy Max Kaiser and see what he's got to say today.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. To frack or not to frack, that is the question. You will not be asked. Stacy.
No, Max. The Queen's speech to Parliament will be June 3rd, and this headline is telling you what she will be saying. Trespass law overhauled to make it easier for frackers. Firms will be able to access underground gas without asking landowners for permission.
Right. Well, this is really a tragedy. I mean, it's this ongoing fracking tragedy here in the UK. As we've been reporting, fracking is economically unsound. It's obviously environmentally unsound. It does give people cancer. And now they're adding this new layer of legal, how would you describe it? Where they're just going to ignore trespassing law?
This is like the days of Robin Hood. The sheriff is coming into town. And in fact, you have images on this article from the Daily Mail from the Balcombe protests. And you see the protesters being beaten to a pulp by the police who are acting on behalf of Quadrilla and the other corporations.
Quadrilla.
Coming in. Yeah.
Sounds like Godzilla.
Exactly.
It's a huge fracking monster. But they're not paying any respect to private property. Remember, the whole thing about this country is the reason the oligarchs come here is because the UK has a modicum of respect for private property. But then here comes the Queen, you know, shaking her little tush, saying, you know what, in my Queen's speech, I'm going to override this idea of private property because, after all, that was part of the whole modern era of capitalism, and I'm a feudalist, and I prefer the fact that it's all my land anyway. I think the royal, whatchamacallit, own like 60 or 70% of all the land mass anyway. They're just
no, well, actually, what happens in the UK is that the Crown owns all mineral rights. Nobody, individual. It doesn't matter if they find, you know, the equivalent of Bergen oil field under your land. You don't own any of it, but they could drill it. It all goes to the government. In fact, in this case, what they're going to do, the reform of the law would extend the existing rights of water, gas, and coal mining companies set out in the Coal Act of 1998 to go under people's land without permission. Compensation of around £100 is likely to be offered to landowners. So here you have these thousands and thousands of lorries that will be bringing in not only the equipment to drill, but they'll also be bringing in the water to drill. Because fracking, what happens is you put in the rig, drill down, and then it goes up to a mile horizontally out underneath your land. So it requires a lot of water, however, and chemicals. They'll be blasting it under your land in order to take the natural gas.
Yeah, and let's be clear about something. The amount of energy it takes to frack is more than the energy you get out of the ground fracking. So it's an energy negative process where you lose BTU, you lose British thermal units, you lose energy. So where does that difference go? If you're going to lose energy on every fracking well you do, how does it all add up? It goes to the national debt, which is still in this country skyrocketing. So you get these fracking corporations like Quadrilla to get the Queen to front their operations. And then, of course, when economically it fails, because we've already seen the failure in America, fracking is an economically unsound way to get energy out of the ground, they're going to add it to the national debt. And to keep that debt from biting them in the Queen's tushy-tush, they're going to keep interest rates at artificially low levels, which means that the wealth and income gap will become even greater, and the speculation in places like London will become even more pronounced. So the cycle of interest rate apartheid, and now the Queen Elizabeth is participating in interest rate apartheid right now.
Well,
that's a great legacy, Queen. Yeah, you've done really well. Let's take this Jubilee Bridge, tear it down, you're a disgrace.
Well, one thing about the UK, Max, is the Prime Minister writes her speech to Parliament. So this is why it's actually delayed by a month. It was supposed to
be
May.
Is it like the Muppets? Does somebody have their hand up the Queen's skirt and they're going, "Hello, I'm the Queen, and we're going to let fracking happen in the UK. Hello? Where's the Duke? Hello?" Or does she have a sentient human being? I mean, I know she's old. She's not senile. So how come she has no self-respect?
Well, this is the way it works here. The Prime Minister, it's his policies. He puts them to the Queen. The Queen reads it, and that's what she's there for. It's a big pomp and circumstance that makes the people accept what is said. Now, of course, David Cameron is also trying to take down wind turbines because those are a blight on the landscape. Wait until you see what fracking looks like because that is really a blight on the landscape. But this is how they operate. This is the way politicians work.
Who wrote that speech for David Cameron? Quadrilla?
Exactly.
And the other energy monopolists and oligopolists, they write the speeches for David Cameron, George Osborne, and the Queen. I'm surprised. You know, because the Queen, you would think she'd have more self-respect.
Well, whatever. So let's turn to what George Osborne is saying. Chancellor George Osborne is offering generous tax breaks to kickstart the technology. He believes fracking for shale gas could herald an energy revolution that will boost the economy, make Britain more self-sufficient, and put an end to sky-high bills for greedy energy firms. Notice how he uses greedy energy firms there, and yet somehow these are benevolent, benign dictator, corporations that are going to come in and drill under your land without permission, without asking you, and throw you £100. These are genuine neo-feudal times. Remember, the lords would just ride over the peasants who got in the way in the middle of town and just throw them a bob or two and keep on going. Here we have the same thing. Here the British population, who supports invasions around the world, by the way, for this very sort of thing, like Chavez, they thought was the height of all evil. Maduro, his replacement, is the height of evil because of he doesn't respect private property. Here, they'll be like, whatever, they threw me £100.
Osborne's clearly psychotic. I mean, just in that speech, he's saying we're going to protect ourselves from greedy energy companies by throwing an enormous subsidy to greedy energy companies.
Yeah.
Okay, it's the Psycho School of Economics from the film Psycho, where, if you recall, the lead of the Psycho was
Norman Bates.
Norman Bates was at war with himself, playing himself as his mother. So maybe the Queen is actually George Osborne dressed up like an old woman. This is the plot of Psycho. So the Queen is George Osborne dressed up like an old woman, and George Osborne at number 11 Downing Street is convincing the old woman that they should be fracking. And then the old woman tells George, "Oh, George, we need fracking to help the energy, greedy energy companies." And then George says, "Yeah, you old lady, we need to protect ourselves."
Now, here in the UK, the Crown owns all the mineral rights, so you're going to get £100 to let them drill there. They'll just drill there. In the United States, here's an article from 2 years ago, okay, to show you the truth. Beyond all this propaganda about we're going to free ourselves from Russia's natural gas or Qatar or Algeria, we're going to free ourselves,
the
right?
The truth! The truth! Stacey, lay the truth on me, baby! I want to hear the truth, baby!
Here's just one of the costs of natural gas beyond the environmental costs. Taxpayers pay as fracking trucks overwhelm rural cow paths. So basically, they're calling it cow paths in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Wyoming, North Dakota, Texas, that these are roads not built for these giant, huge 33,000 kilo trucks that have to rumble through. A surge in hydraulic fracturing to get gas and oil trapped in rock means drillers need to haul hundreds of truckloads of sand, water, and equipment for a single well. Drilling that added jobs and tax revenues for many states has also increased traffic on roads too flimsy to handle the 80,000 pound or 36,000 kilo trucks that serve well sites. So technically, a lot of the states say they have to pay for the resurfacing of the roads after, but there's no way to enforce it, so a lot of the companies don't actually pay to have the roads resurfaced, leaving the taxpayer with tens of millions of dollars in cost to repave the roads.
Right. What will happen is Quadrilla, this energy company, they will incur enormous costs that will be 10 times any benefit in terms of the energy derived from fracking, through environmental costs, through infrastructure costs that need to be rebuilt, through lawsuits. And after they extract some fracked gas, which won't be anywhere near the amount of energy that took to get that gas, they will declare bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And Quadrilla will declare bankruptcy, and they'll just leave the scene, and they'll leave all the garbage and all the environmental waste on the scene. They'll be nowhere to be found. They'll probably be in Switzerland somewhere, and they'll just be gone. And they'll just say, "Well, we're bankrupt. That's the way the market works. The market's a genius. You're an idiot. And I'm sorry, but your kid's got cancer, but we're Quadrilla."
Now, I think it's Halliburton that's coming in here. I think Quadrilla actually might be leaving and giving it to Halliburton, because Halliburton is the one that got the exemptions. There's a Halliburton exemption to the Clean Water Act in America, so they're allowed to dump stuff in there. This is what Cheney got in there when he was in the vice presidency, really the presidency.
Yeah, they're concerned about a few gypsies on Oxford Street begging for nickels, but they let Halliburton in? That's to get your priorities up your schving-schving for sure, George Osborne.
So here they said that Texas just paid $40 million to fix the roads leading to the Barnett Shale region over in the Marcellus Shale, which runs from New York to Tennessee. New York did an investigation to find out what the cost would be to New York State should they allow fracking in there. And while New York State has yet to allow fracking for gas, it is weighing the potential impact on roads. A draft study last year from the state's Department of Transportation found that hundreds of miles of roads and scores of bridges would need to be reconstructed to handle gas industry trucks at a cost of $211 million to $378 million. Because one thing about this natural gas compared to the fracking natural gas compared to, say, what you have in Russia or Iran or Qatar or Algeria is there, you know, you have to dig the well, and it does require a lot of transportation and trucks and stuff like that. But it lasts for like 20 years. Here they last for 12 months, maybe 18 months at most. So you're going to have to constantly, this is going to be a never ending. And here they're saying that they have 40 years supply of natural gas should they tear up the entire countryside between Liverpool, Manchester, and Sheffield.
Right. They're incredibly capital intensive. And you're in a period of peak capital.
Interest rates are at a 350-year low.
Right. So as soon as interest rates pop up, then all the economics of fracking completely are destroyed, and makes no economic sense. And it's just a non-starter from day one. But the propaganda is genius, because they'll say what Cameron will say and what the Queen will say. I don't know why I'm rubbing my eye like this, but all I can say is that what the Queen will say. Is that we, and George Osborne and Cameron will say, is that this is the way to get back at Russia. It's Russia. We're going to get back at Russia by fracking you to death. Yeah, that's a really good idea. I think maybe just blow your brains out and save everybody the trouble of all the environmental damage.
So, and finally here, even the newer roads are vulnerable to these giant, huge lorries, because a portion of U.S. Highway 2 near Williston, North Dakota, completed in 2004, is already being reconstructed. Jamie Olson, a spokesman for the Department of Transportation, said in an email, traffic across the state has increased 10% in the past year and 25% near the Bakken Shale formation where oil is being produced. So they had planned for this highway to last 20 years, even planning it for the natural gas fracking vehicles, but it only lasted 9 years.
The only way this fracking story would be have a positive ending is if they reported, Quadrilla reported, they're going to replace the drill head with Piers Morgan's head. They're going to try to drill through the crust of Britain, of the earth, of with Piers Morgan pinhead. Just and the Jeremy Clarkson can be, you know, along cheering it on the, those are British TV people, if you don't know, outside of this little Druid Island. All right, Stacey Herbert, we got to go. Thank you.
Well, there you go. You got Negro problems. You got mestizo problems. You got nuclear radiation problems. You got political party problems. You've got fracking problems, you got tar sands oil problems, you've got weather problems. Welcome to 2014. That's it for today. And if that isn't enough to make you want to, you listen to our show, I'm losing people. I'm losing subscribers because they're committing suicide. 14-5.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather.
Dean 5.